To be prepared for war is one of the most effective ways of preserving peace.
George Washington said it in his address to Congress, January 8, 1790. And the assembled legislators applauded and nodded in complete agreement and promptly forgot the president's words in the press of more ordinary business. It would be 24 years before Congress would remember them again. And on that day, they would be reminded by an unforgettable sight, by the smoking ruins of the Capitol itself. August 24th, 1814. The burning of Washington.
This is Inheritance, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the American Legion. Stories out of the great fabric of the American past. Stories of our inheritance.
A nation's heritage is made of many things, of visions, dreams, brave moments, and great achievements. It is also made of mistakes and failures, the kind that patriotic orators prefer to forget on the 4th of July. Yet sometimes the memory of those mistakes can be as valuable as that of our proudest traditions. For unless a nation is willing to learn and profit from the errors of the past, it may not long survive. It was August 18th of 1814, and the city of Washington drowsed in the discomfort of a typically hot, humid August day. The nation was entering the third year of its second war against Great Britain. A British fleet under Admiral Cockburn was still blockading and bombarding the shores of Chesapeake Bay. But there was hardly a soldier to be seen on the streets of the nation's capital, and the citizens went their way unconcerned with anything more important than the weather. A pig rolled in a mud hole on Pennsylvania Avenue. All was quiet along the Potomac as a weary dispatch rider galloped into town, past the printing shop of Gales and Seton, where the newspaper called the National Intelligencer was published.
Man's a fool to flog his horse on a day like this.
Must be carrying dispatches for the War Department. Perhaps I better go down there and see what's up.
Oh, hold up there now. Wait till we've got the paper set up in the press. Now, what was that that last paragraph about Cockburn again?
And if he should dare set foot on sacred American soil, rest assured that an aroused citizenry will spring to arms and singe the coattails of that cowardly, cringing cockatoo, Admiral Cockburn.
Oh, wait a minute. You can't say that.
Why not? Sir, are you standing up for that rascal Cockburn?
Oh, but you still can't say cringing, cowardly cockatoo Cockburn. We haven't got that many C's left in the typecase.
Farther down the street, the galloping horse passed the government patent office, where Dr. Thornton was listening patiently, if wearily, to an inventor with an idea for driving the Royal Navy from Chesapeake Bay, something to do with training a new breed of barnacles to eat the bottoms out of British boats. Up at one end of Pennsylvania Avenue, Dolly Madison, the president's wife, was planning a dinner party with the aid of John Sousa, the White House steward.
And we will need service for 40. That is, if the French minister comes. Oh, poor man. Now that Bonaparte has abdicated, I suppose he hardly knows where he stands.
Oui, madame. Will we use the heavy silver plate?
Of course, and see that it's well polished.
Très bien, madame.
Oh, dear. So much to do before Wednesday night. I do hope it doesn't rain that night. Would be a pity if anything spoiled the party.
Meanwhile, at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, Representative Stewart was rising to query a meeting of the House Committee on Military Affairs.
Sir, I have received a private intelligence from Maryland that a British fleet of 22 sail has just been sighted in the Chesapeake, en route to join Admiral Cockburn's forces off the Patuxent River. Now, may I ask if the Honorable Chairman has had any official confirmation of this news?
We have no such word.
Well, I have reason to believe the information is accurate. And if this is true, such reinforcement can have only one meaning. The landing of an invasion force to strike at Baltimore, or at the capital city itself. I ask again if we have made sufficient preparation to meet an invader.
We have been over this before, Mr. Stewart. In any such event, the President has authorized and Congress has approved a proclamation calling up 92,500 militia to the colors.
Where are they then? Your 92,000 troops exist only on paper. The men are at home. The regiments aren't formed. You can't fight off an invasion with paper. I suggest that we call upon the Secretary of War to embody the militia of the district immediately and begin the distribution of arms.
I do not think it necessary for the committee to presume to tell the Secretary what his duty is. At your own request, Mr. Stewart, we made investigation into his preparations only a month ago. And to refresh your memory, I will read the conclusion of our report. That we have examined into the state of preparedness, naval and military, made to receive the enemy, and are satisfied that the preparation is, in every respect, adequate to the emergency, and that no measures are necessary on the part of the House to make it more complete. The meeting is adjourned.
At the War Department, the Secretary himself suddenly was feeling a little less confident of his own preparations. When the weary dispatch rider brought official news that the reinforced British fleet had entered the Patuxent River, Secretary Armstrong hastily conferred with General William Winder, in command of the defense of the area, and General Van Ness of the District of Columbia Militia.
22 sail, Mr. Secretary, and most of them troopships. That can mean only that they're planning to strike somewhere. Neither here or at Annapolis.
Oh, yes. By God, they wouldn't come with such a fleet without meaning to strike somewhere. Ah, but my dear Winder, they certainly will not come here. Now, what the devil would they do here?
They'll hit at Annapolis, then.
No. Baltimore is the place. It's of so much more consequence.
How do you know they won't strike here?
Oh, come now, General Van Ness. We're a 60-mile march from the mouth of the Patuxent. They'd never dare that long a march through hostile country.
Still, it might be a possibility.
Well, Winder, whether they come here or not, it's your responsibility. We must be ready to defend ourselves.
Defend with what, Mr. Secretary? The militia that was guarding the Patuxent was disbanded by order of the War Department. For months I have been pleading that we call up at least 4,000 men so that we could give them a little training.
Now, see here,
in the
Winder,
whole
I...
District of Columbia, there is not a single point fortified. Not a redoubt, dike, or ditch, not a solitary piece of artillery, not a single battalion of regular soldiers, not one company of militia or volunteers properly armed, equipped, or disciplined. Now I ask you, sir, what am I to defend us with?
That is your problem, General Winder. I suggest you ask your uncle, the governor of Maryland. Perhaps he can supply you some troops.
So confused were the reports of the enemy's approach that James Monroe, the Secretary of State, rode out next day with an escort of dragoons to observe the British landing at Benedict. 4,500 soldiers of the king came ashore, looking like twice that number to the anxious watchers. And the British advance began. No one knew what the British target would be. And least of all, Rear Admiral Sir George Cockburn, who'd not yet made up his mind that he would like to dine on Sunday at the White House. But the mere possibility was enough to spread panic in Washington. Women and children began to flee the city, But not a cart nor wagon could be hired for love or money. All had been pressed into service for the military or for the removal of vital government records. On Tuesday, August 23rd, a ragged army of 3,000 volunteers marched out to Battalion Oldfields, spent all day waiting to repel the invader, and then, confused by their failure to appear, straggled back to Washington. Next day, the 24th, back they went again to meet the British at Bladensburg. For poor General Winder, it was not an auspicious day to begin a battle. The weather was oppressively hot, his men exhausted and untrained. The President and the Secretary of State and the Secretary of War were there and all giving conflicting orders. His best battalion of gunners under Commodore Barney were still stationed too far away, and his main source of reinforcement, Colonel Miner's regiment of militia from Virginia, was still back in Washington, beseeching an armory clerk to issue them guns.
195, 196, 197.
Come, get on with it, man. But
please, Colonel. Haste makes waste. Where was I? Oh, yes. 197, 198, 199, 200. Very well now, sir. If you will sign here.
For what?
200 flintlocks and 200 muskets.
200? I've got nearly 1,000 men outside who are waiting for arms.
I'm sorry, sir, but 200 is all that I'm allowed to issue on my own authority.
Confound it, man. There's a battle being fought at Bladensburg. How do you expect my troops to fight without guns?
Well, of course, if you would care to find my superiors and take it up with them.
Where are your superiors?
At the Battle of Bladensburg.
Oh, no, never mind. We'll just take the 200 flintlocks.
Not so fast, Colonel. Remember, haste makes waste. I'll have to count them just once more to make sure there's been no mistake. One, two,
by the time the recount was finished, it was already too late. At Bladensburg, the disciplined British troops had simply swung into line, fired a sharp volley or two, and watched all opposition promptly melt away. The volunteers defending Washington collapsed into a disorderly retreat, leaving only 10 dead and 30 wounded behind. By 4 o'clock in the afternoon, some of them already were straggling back into town in groups of 3 or 4. No longer an army, but a disorganized rabble. The panic was on. There was no hope now of saving the Capitol. At the White House, the silver plate for the dinner party Dolly Madison had planned was all packed in a wagon, along with other valuables. But Dolly still lingered on, reluctant to go.
Polly, want a cracker? Nice, Polly.
Nice, Polly.
Pretty Paul Parrot.
Please, Mrs. Madison, I implore you.
Yes, Mr. Carroll.
There is no more time to waste. You must fly to Virginia at once.
I'm waiting word of my husband.
I assure you he will be safe. He is in the care of Graham's dragoons.
Very well. I was to wait for him here.
But, madam, he may not be able to return this way. The British may have cut off all the roads by now. I beg of you. If you will not think of your personal safety, then remember that you are the wife of the president. What a feather in Cockburn's cap that you allow yourself to be captured. It is your duty to go to Virginia at once.
Oh, dear, I... Oh, very well, Mr. Carroll, if you insist.
Oh, good. Susan.
Oui, monsieur.
Summon the carriage for madame.
Oh, oui, monsieur.
Oh, come now, your coat.
Oh, no.
What is
it? Well, the Stuart portrait of George Washington. We can't leave that here for the British.
But you can't take that with you in the carriage. It's too large. The frame is too heavy.
Well, then we'll simply have to smash the frame. Sousa, a hatchet, please.
Oh, please, Mrs. Madison, leave that to us. I promise you we will save the painting. Now, your carriage is waiting. You must leave at once.
Well, then. Oh, one more thing. The parrot.
Does madame wish to take the bird with her?
No. The poor dear doesn't like to travel. He suffers mal de mer in a carriage. Oh, Sousa, you must find him a nice, safe home.
Oui, madame. Very good, madame. Goodbye, madame.
Bye!
At last, Mrs. Madison was gone. And so was the parrot. The faithful Sousa had taken him to the French ministry and entrusted him into the tender care of the minister's cook. A little later, the weary president rode up to the White House, surrounded by his aides. A hasty council of war was held. It was agreed that all must flee before the British advance guard appeared. Quickly, Mr. Madison followed his wife across the bridge to Virginia and safety. At the Navy Yard and the armories, combustibles and powder trains were being laid. Orders were to burn or blow up all arms and munitions to prevent them falling into the hands of the enemy. At the arsenal at Greenleaf's Point...
Sir, we've just found 20 more kegs of powder.
There are no more wagons. You'll have to destroy it. Don't bother me, Pusey. There's no time to waste.
But, sir, there's that old dry well out back. Perhaps we could save the powder by hiding it there.
Well, maybe it's worth a chance. All right. Have the men put the powder in the bottom of the well. And let's hope the British don't get nosy. Or thirsty.
By 6 o'clock, when the British marched in, the sky was already filled with a fine red glare from fires set by the Americans themselves at the Navy Yard and the Armory. General Robert Ross, the British Army commander, came riding into town on a fine bay mare.
What a spectacle, eh, Major? What a sight to see.
Yes, sir. Well, they must have fired the whole naval yard. Oh, there goes a powder magazine now.
Well, they're saving us the trouble. You know, I thought we'd have more opposition than this. I haven't heard a shot fired.
General! General Ross! Are you hurt?
No, I... What happened to my horse?
Someone took a shot at you from that house over there.
Oh. All right. Take a squad and find the man who did it. And then... burn down the house.
The troops moved on to the Capitol building, and in a holiday mood with hoots and jeers, fired a volley through the windows. And legend has it, though the story may not be true, that Admiral Cockburn, that tough old sea dog, mounted the speaker's rostrum in the house and signaled for quiet.
Order! Order in the house! I will now put the following motion. Shall this harbor of Yankee democracy be burned? All for it will say aye.
Aye!
Very well. The motion is carried.
Quickly, the flames sprang up. A little later, Cockburn's column rolled down Pennsylvania Avenue to the deserted White House. The Admiral did not stay for dinner, as he'd promised. Instead, he conducted a leisurely inspection and even picked up some souvenirs to take home. A cushion from Dolly Madison's chair, an old hat that her husband had left behind. Then the windows were smashed out. The lighted port fires set the curtains ablaze. And across the Potomac, where he had taken refuge, the president watched another bright red glow mount in the sky and wondered where his wife and his army had gone. By now, all of Washington was threatened by the fires set by both the British and the retreating Americans. But then, a summer shower came up, and the gentle rain that fell from heaven was enough to keep the fires from spreading. The British rested for the night and resumed their work of destruction in the morning. At the printing office of Gales and Seton, Admiral Cockburn was reading his latest press clippings from the National Intelligencer.
Cowardly, cringing cockatoo, eh? All right. Lay to it, lads. Let's show them what we think of their infernal wrath.
Admiral Cockburn, sir.
Eh? What is it, Major Waters?
I have an American here to see you, sir.
American, eh? What's he doing here? He isn't connected with this blasted intelligencer, is he?
Oh, no, sir. I'm Dr. Thornton of the Government Patent Office.
Well, come speak up. What is it you want, sir?
Admiral, I've heard that you plan to burn the patent office. I've come to beg you not to do it.
No?
And why shouldn't I?
It would serve no military purpose, sir. I ask you to spare it in the interest of science.
No. Oh, well, there's no point in being too barbaric about it. Very well, Major Waters. See to it that the patent office is spared. And inform the troops that hereafter we will confine the burning to military installations.
Thank you, sir.
There's one satisfaction I will not be cheated of. All right, lads, let's finish this job. And destroy every sea you can find in the type case. Sink me if this blasted rag ever abuses the name of Cockburn again.
The burning of barracks and military installations went on. 200 British soldiers marched out to the arsenal at Greenleaf's Point and finished putting it to the torch.
Ah, jolly good, Sergeant. A very fine blaze. Oh, there's nothing more to be done here. Form the men up and move on.
Aye, sir.
You better douse your port fire in that well. You won't be needing it any longer.
Oh, yes, sir. All right, Smith. Drop it in.
The lighted port fire dropped down the well was the first mistake the British had made. For the well was not only dry, but packed with the hidden kegs of powder. When the explosion had cleared, 10 men lay dead and 50 wounded. More casualties, by an ironic chance, than the British forces had suffered in capturing the city. The elements also began to conspire against them. The sky darkened. Suddenly, a rain and windstorm of hurricane velocity whipped over Washington, sending rooftops sailing through the sky, drenching the fires and the ardor of the British. As night grew on and the storm grew worse, General Ross and Admiral Cockburn conferred.
Well, General.
Sir, I think it's time we retired. We're outnumbered here. There's been enemy cavalry reported beyond Georgetown. And we're 50 miles from our supporting fleet.
That's true enough.
It's only a matter of time till the Yankees rally. I say, better withdraw now while we have the darkness and the storm to cover us.
Well, we've done everything we set out to do. All right, call in your pickets and sound the retreat.
The burning of Washington was over, and the city had been saved, not by arms or valor, but by the lucky chance of a summer rain. The British column marched back again with banners flying, and without even a musket shot to speed it on its way. It had been a truly extraordinary military feat of arms, and one that astonished the world as much as it humiliated America. For who could have believed that an army of only 4,500 men could invade a hostile nation of 10 million souls, penetrate its heartland for 60 miles without artillery or cavalry support, capture and burn the capital, and escape with hardly a scratch. But the feat was made possible not only by British daring, but also by American carelessness of almost comic opera proportions, by total unpreparedness, by our own disregard of George Washington's advice.
To be prepared for war is one of the most effective means of preserving the peace.
It was not the first time we forgot, nor would it be the last. From that day to this, right up to Pearl Harbor, America has somehow survived the habit of entering each new war still unprepared. But what about the next one, if there should be a next? The world has changed, and so has war. And neither one for the better. War no longer comes with ample warning, and there is no reprieve for the burning city in the gentle fall of a radioactive rain.
have been listening to Inheritance, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the American Legion. And now it's our privilege to hear from the chairman of the National Security Commission of the American Legion, Mr. Bruce Henderson. Mr. Henderson.
The American Legion, an organization of 3 million veterans of wartime military service who have seen the horrors of war, together with the million members of our auxiliary, is pledged to promote peace and goodwill on earth. This is the goal of every thinking American. Yet every thinking American is now aware of the power of politics of the Cold War and realizes that every weakness invites aggression. From all appearances, this conflict will continue for many years to come. Years during which America must maintain its strength for peace in every respect. Moral, political, economic, and military. This is the responsibility and the obligation of every American. We know that we cannot support, during the years to come, a regular military force on active duty that would be large enough to cope with an all-out war. Yet we must have a stable, professional force large enough to meet and blunt a sudden attack. To accomplish this, we must encourage high-type young Americans to follow military careers by increasing service attractiveness. The Legion is urging prompt approval of the Career Incentive Act of 1955. But this rather small professional force must be backed up by a ready reserve, organized and equipped for immediate service. We are hoping that the Congress responds to the President's appeal for an effective program. Ultimately, of course, in event of all-out war, the burden must fall upon all of us, whether we are called upon for military service or remain at home. It will be too late to train for survival after a supersonic atomic attack. We must be prepared in advance. It is for this reason that the Legion has been insistent upon the creation of civilian-controlled agencies to give adequate civil defense training to those who will remain at home and adequate military training to everyone who is liable for such service. The American Legion believes that a consistent and intelligent, long-range national security program must be maintained at all times to ensure the preservation of our precious inheritance of freedom.
Thank you, Mr. Henderson. Next week, Inheritance will take you on another journey through the pages of American history. Today's story was written by Dorothea Harris. Included in the cast were John McGovern, Matt Crowley, Richard Newton, Ronald Long, Alan Bergman, Ed Jerome, John Larkin, Richard Hamilton, Leon Janney, John Arison, and Ann Seymour. Norman Rose was the narrator. The music was composed and conducted by Roy Scheel. This is Roger Bowman speaking. Inheritance was produced by William Welch and directed by Daniel Sutter. This has been an NBC Radio Network production.
Enjoy variety entertainment on the Dennis Day Show, today over most NBC radio stations.